and with Bonds, and that there's no hard evidence to prove Bonds knowingly lied. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
A Boston hospital is declaring a new milestone with the first full face transplant ever performed in the United States. Doctors were scheduled to release details today about an operation performed last week on a 25-year-old patient. Dr. Bodan Pomahawk led a medical team of 30 people to replace Alice Ween's lips, nose, facial skin muscles, and nerves. Although this full facial transplant was the first in the U.S., last year Spain became the first in the world to perform the full face transplant operation. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, investing in strong futures for kids by promoting reading at grade level by the third grade at aecf.org.
You'll find thousands of used albums, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale, held on April 30th. We'll be at the new site, the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive in Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the final episode of HBO's Big Love with the show's creators, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, who say it's going to be hard to let the characters go.
They are in your head 24/7. Yeah, you're on the toilet, the characters are talking in your head. You're shaving, the characters are in your head. You're doing the dishes, you're talking to the characters.
Join us.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer, Jason Croft at the controls. This hour, Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this hour of Focus, we'll go to the archives for a show we first broadcast in January, so that means that in this hour of Focus, we'll not be taking calls. The United States has more marriages than any other Western nation. So just looking at that, you would have to think that marriage was very important to us. It is also true that we have a very high rate of divorce, and it is also true that we have a very high rate of remarriage. A very confusing picture. Our guest for this morning, sociologist Andrew Cherlin, says that our attitudes toward marriage are very complicated, and something that really sets us apart, that is, sets the United States apart from other Western countries. We'll talk in this part of Focus about why there has been so much change and why it is that family life in this country is so turbulent. All of this comes from a book that he has authored. The title is The Marriage Go-Round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today. This is a book that he first published a couple of years ago, is now available in a paperback edition published by Vintage. So if you're interested in reading it and looking at some of his analysis, including a lot of statistical information. It's there, so you can find it in the bookstore. I'm sure you can find it in the library. On this program, questions are welcome. We always encourage people to call in, but we hope that people will be on the topic, and we'll try to be brief. That way, we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep our conversation moving. Our guest, Andrew Cherlin, is a professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins University. He does research on families and public policy, and he's published books and articles on a number of topics, including marriage and divorce, children's well-being, intergenerational relations, family policy, and welfare policy. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Cherlin, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Well, I think that it's what I suppose makes it a little bit confusing is that depending upon what sort of questions you ask and what sort of statistics you look at, you come away with a very different idea about marriage in this country. If, for example, we just start with the expectation that people will be married, the fact that people do get married at very high rates, what are those numbers, just to start off? If we just look at marriage, people who get married.
80 to 90% of all people will eventually get married in this country.
And is that the fact that people do get married and the fact that people somehow think that's just a part of life, that's something that you do, is that something that separates us from countries in Europe, Canada, Australia, the other places at which you've looked?
That's one of the things that separates us. Marriage is just more important here. In some European countries, there's less emphasis on it. It doesn't mean as much. Here, marriage is still important, even though it's optional, even though it's not as necessary as it was 50 years ago, because there are other ways you can lead an adult life. Still, people want to do it, and it has more prestige and value here than in many other wealthy countries.
Mm-hmm. So it is. We have here not just there is some kind of moral imperative, perhaps behind marriage, but there is bound up with marriage this idea that it's an important stage of life. It's something that says that you are an established person. It seems to be that the status of the institution and being part of that institution is something that's important to us.
Yes. As you said, it's a way of showing that you're an established person, that you have a successful life. It's almost become like the ultimate merit badge, the marriage badge. And marriage, 50 years ago, used to be the first step into adulthood. Did that, then you got an apartment and a job. Now it's often the last step. People wait until everything else is going well. They have jobs. They may be living together. They might even have a kid together. And finally, when they think they've got their total act together, they get married to show themselves and others that they really have a first-class personal life.
Yeah, and something I'm sure we'll come back to is the subject of same-sex marriage and why that is so contentious in this country, and much more so than in other places. But in fact, this our attitudes. Part of the answer to that question, well, why is it so contentious? Is it has a lot to do with how it is in this country. We think about marriage and how we think differently in this country than people do, say, in Europe.
The battle over same-sex marriage has been fiercer here than in most other countries. And the reason, because marriage is that marriage means so much. It's such an important symbol to people. You know, in some European countries, gay and lesbian activists say, wait a minute, why do we want to get involved with this marriage institution, which is an old-fashioned way of living together that's on its way out? We don't care so much about marriage. Just give us legal rights and that's enough. In the U.S., that's not enough. Many more gay and lesbian activists say no, in the U.S., in order to have a first-class personal life, to be recognized as such, you need to be married. And so we want marriage, too. What happens then is we're fighting over marriage more than other countries because it matters more here than in other places.
All right. Well, now, having established all of this, that marriage means a lot to us, that people have this high expectation that at some point in their life they will be married, and Americans at very high rates do marry, all of that would say, well, we think that marriage is very important. So then when you look at divorce statistics, though, that would seem to suggest, well, gosh, if we're divorcing at these really high rates, what does that tell us about what we think about marriage?
How can it be that we have high marriage rates and high divorce rates at the same time? Here's what I think is going on. We do value marriage a lot in this country, more than people in many other Western countries do. So there's a strong value on the bonds of marriage. On the other hand, we also value personal growth, personal development, call it individualism, more than that. We also value individualism a lot, too. You know, you can find other countries where marriage is strong, like Italy, for example, and you can find other countries where a belief in individualism and personal growth is strong, let's say Sweden or Denmark, Scandinavian countries. But you can't find another country where both values are strong. We want to get married because we value the bonds of marriage, but we evaluate our marriages in a very personal way. Am I getting what I need from this marriage? You know, is my personal growth enough from this marriage? And because of the way we evaluate it, if we don't think we're getting enough individual satisfaction, we're likely to leave. So we get married. We constantly look at our marriages to see if they're fulfilling personal needs. And if not, we get divorced. And then often we marry again, creating this movement across different kinds of family lives that people have.
Yeah, and that's what really makes this so fascinating and also maybe confusing is that you make this argument that we carry around in our heads two very conflicting notions when it comes to the subject of marriage, that we think both that marriage is really important, we want to be married, and yet at the same time, we have this idea that our individual satisfaction is important as well. And so here there are two things pulling in opposite directions. And in fact, you can even, as people respond to surveys, depending on how, what sort of questions you ask and how you ask them, you can get them to tell you actually both, things.
If you say to Americans in a survey, do you agree that marriage is a very important relationship that should only be ended under extreme circumstances? They say, yes, of course. But then if you ask them in the same survey 20 minutes later, do you think an unhappy married couple ought to stay together for the sake of the children? Most people say no, believe it or not. Why? Well, if you cue them in the direction of the value of marriage being good by saying, is marriage important? They say, oh, yes. But then if you get them thinking about personal satisfaction, should you stay together if you're unhappy? They say no. It's that contradiction that makes us different from other countries and creates this movement, much more movement across family lives than in other places.
Yeah, and just to add one more element here, in addition to the fact that we have high rates of marriage, high rates of divorce, high rates of remarriage, we also have very high rates of people cohabiting, that is, people living with one another. But even there, there seems to be more more turnover in relationships than in other countries.
The growth of cohabiting or living together relationships has been very strong over the last few decades, and those relationships are short and create even more turnover. You know, in some places in Europe, like Sweden or France, there are lots of cohabiting couples who live together for 20 or 30 years, have kids. They're just like married couples. That's not the case here. At least so far, our living together relationships tend to be short. You live together for a year or two, and then either you break up or you get married. So the growth of living together relationships has caused even more going in and out of relationships than was the case a couple of decades ago.
How, if you take a look at attitudes in Europe, and people's, whether or not they think that it's important to be married. If you have couples who are together long-term, is there something, do they do something in law that provides the sort of legal protections that come with being married that make it possible to have those things and yet not have to be married, so that people would say, well, there are certain as long as certain things are in place, and may also have something to do with the way healthcare is delivered, I suppose. As long as all that's in place, well, there's really no compelling reason to be married.
That's right. In the United States, as most people know, if you're married, you get to fill out a joint federal tax return. Saves you some money compared to a living together couple where a man makes a lot of money and the woman doesn't make so much. In some other countries, there's no such thing as a joint tax return for married couples. You just file as an individual. And so there's less reason to be married in those countries from a kind of practical economic standpoint, at least concerning taxes, because you don't get a break. So in other countries, there have been more rights extended to cohabiting couples, and there's less reason to get married than is the case here.
And what are there attitudes toward people having children who are not married? Do they feel that somehow having those children be quote unquote legitimate, that just doesn't matter very much?
Yes, in most countries, and I would say even increasingly here too, it's the case that nobody cares too much if you're married. Mm-hmm. There was an election in France a few years ago, and one of the candidates, a woman, had lived with her partner for 30 years and had three or four children, and they'd never married. Now, can you imagine an American running for president who'd been living with a partner for 30 years and had three or four kids without being married? It's impossible to imagine that. Mm-hmm. But in France, nobody particularly cared that much. Here, people care about marriage, but increasingly it's true here that people accept children outside of marriage.
Yeah.
At least among the people who don't have a college degree, it's very common these days to have a kid in a living together relationship.
This is something that's very interesting and I think has gotten some recent attention in media, the fact that it seems that there are growing numbers of people, particularly young people and people who do not have benefit of college education, who have seemed to have no difficulty with the idea of people living together, having a sexual relationship, having children, and not being married. Not that, again, as you say, not that they don't think that marriage is important or something that they would want to do someday, but that it's not something that's really that high on their list.
Among people with the let's say, just a high school education, increasingly they can't find the kind of stable work that they think would support a marriage. You know, those factory jobs that used to be there for people with a high school education have gone overseas or moved into computer chips. And so they don't think they have what it takes to get married. But increasingly, many of them say, having a child is so important that we're not going to wait around to see if we ever find somebody to marry. I want a kid now, and I'm not willing to put that off. Marriage is optional. If I get there, that's great. I hope I do. Having a kid is not optional. That's something I must do, and I'm not willing to wait a long time. You know, as I look around, I don't see a good marriage partner, but I'll be darned if I'm going to give up the chance to have children. That's the attitude that more and more Americans are having, especially those who are having trouble finding jobs in our transformed economy.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Andrew Cherlin. He is professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins University and has written books and articles on marriage and divorce, on children's well-being, on family policy, on welfare policy. If you're interested in reading some more on this subject of marriage in America, you might look at his book, The Marriage Go-Round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today. It is published by Vintage. It's now out in the paperback. And questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. We'll go to right to them, somebody on a cell phone, and this is someone calling from Paxton. So line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Very provocative. I love the topic. I just make a couple of observations from my unique, or maybe not so unique, point of view and offer some questions to the guest. I'm in my 50s. I was the youngest of four growing up in Chicago, and my parents, they had their troubles. It wasn't a perfect existence, but I can tell you that divorce was not even an option. Back then, very, very few people got divorced, and it's just kind of the way it is. I did want to echo what your guest said. I have a couple of nephews and nieces. They're approaching 30, and they have kind of settled into their own professional life. I think they want to get married, but it's not, what would you say, the sense of urgency that maybe perhaps it once was. Also, too, my wife and I have found ourselves going to a lot more weddings where the bride is either pregnant or they're either first or second child, and for whatever reason, there's not a whole lot of negative stigma with that anymore, where growing up, you know, that would be just, you know, it'd be very, very bad on the family. But my question is, given the out-of-wedlock rates for some segments of this population, I think it's as much as 80%, maybe higher, there's been a lot of talk about the dissolution of the American family and the crumbling of the foundation of this, the fabric of this country. I was wondering if your guests could speak to any negative aspects, or are there negative aspects with the high amount of people having children out of wedlock and sometimes from multiple partners, and the impact that has on our society. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
There certainly is an impact of people having children outside of marriage. And let me say, it's very common, as you relate, to go to a wedding today where the kids are in tow coming after the bride and the groom. But, you know, the great growth in out-of-wedlock childbearing in this country over the last couple of decades has not been among poor single teenagers living with the grandmothers. It's been among cohabiting couples in their 20s, many of them with a high school degree. That's been the driving engine now. So what we're having is an increasing group of people who are postponing marriage but not postponing having children and willing to live with their partners in very unstable relationships. You know, if there are no kids involved, I don't have a problem with people living with somebody. If there are kids involved, a series of relationships, you cohabit with somebody, that relationship breaks up, somebody else moves in, I think can cause some difficulties for kids. So I think we have to watch out for giving kids too many changes to cope with. That's the real problem, I think, of the out-of-wedlock pregnancies. We think of, you know, poor minority mothers, but the growth has been among white high school graduates who live with somebody in an unstable relationship and yet go ahead and have kids. What happens to those kids? How vulnerable they become if they have a series of parents and parent figures moving in and out of the household is, I think, the crux of the problem here.
Mm. Well, just, you know, certainly in recent decades, there's been a great deal of concern expressed about the impact on kids of alternate family structures, or at least if you consider the nuclear family that was typical of, say, middle and upper class people in the 50s and 60s, if that's your baseline, looking at other sorts of family structures, a lot of people have asked this question, well, is growing up in that kind of family, is that a problem for kids? And depending on whether you think it is or not, I'm sure you can marshal evidence to show that it is or not. I mean, really, if you try to look at this in a sort of objective way, is there some answer to that? What is the answer to that question?
I think that what kids need is stability, stable care. So a two-parent family that with two parents who are married probably provides more stable care than other kinds. But I think a single parent can provide good, stable care. What I think is the problem for kids is turnover, this movement in and out of different relationships. So I would say, I'm not just saying get married. I'm saying slow down. Take your time. If you have kids, don't move a partner into that household until you're sure that he or she will stay there for a while and will help your kids out. So I'm in favor of stable care arrangements because I think that's what kids need. Two-parent families do it very well, but so can a stable single parent.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Lafayette. Line one right here. Hello. Call it there, line one, Lafayette. Well, maybe not. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Also, we do have email, so we'd like to send in your comment that way. You can write us at will-talk, just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. And again, our guest for this hour of focus is Andrew Cherlin. He's professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. We're going to try again, I think, with our line one in Lafayette. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, David, could you spell the name of your guest?
Yes, I certainly can. C-H-E-R-L-I-N, Cherlin.
Cherlin. Okay. Yep. To the guest himself, perhaps we could note the enormous change in social attitudes by the presidential campaign some 50 years ago, I guess, when Adlai Stevenson received enormous resistance from the electorate and certainly from the press because he was divorced.
Yes, and Nelson Rockefeller, too. Do you remember the governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller?
Yes.
He was going to run for president, but he had been divorced, and he was so disgraced by the divorce that he wasn't allowed to run. Now, who cares? We've had a number of presidents who've been divorced and remarried, some of them, but it doesn't carry the stigma that it once did.
In fact, so have several of the Methodist pastors, in my experience.
Right. There's much more acceptance of divorce, even among American religious institutions, as you say. Churches say divorce is not good, but, you know, if you repent and have faith in God, we'll help you heal up from it. Don't leave our church.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. And other questions, again, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about the history in America of these two dominant but contradictory ideas we have about marriage, starting with the idea that marriage is a sacred institution. It's important for society. When you get married, you're married for life, and so forth. That's the one that seems to be certainly closely linked with people's religious attitudes, and the one that tends to be if you look at American history, tends to be the one that's older and has been established here for a longer period of time.
Ever since the colonial days, the settlers placed a lot of importance on marriage, the kind of religion that the first settlers brought over, the Protestant religion, said that marriage was the foundation of society. So we've always been very strong on marriage. But, you know, from the start, we had higher divorce rates here than in other European countries, even though they were tiny compared to what they are today. In England, it was illegal to get divorced until about 1850. And in Catholic countries in Europe, there was no divorce. So from the start, we had more divorce. And in the 1700s and 1800s, you can find the writings of leaders who were very, very concerned about the so-called high divorce rates, which we would call laughably low, but which were concerning to them. So from the start, we've had more divorce, although not nearly as much as today, and we've had more marriage. So both of those are embedded in history, and that's one of the reasons why we have this contradictory set of values today, where marriage is great, but if you're unhappy with your marriage, you can think of your own happiness and how that might be better if you leave your marriage and therefore get divorced.
Well,
both are embedded.
That's that second idea seems to be something that you really started to see more and more of, and I guess this idea that the purpose of marriage is primarily for the fulfillment of the, yes, it's for children, yes, it's for bedrock of society, all that kind of stuff. But the idea that the purpose of marriage is to enhance the personal fulfillment of the individuals is something that you start to see more and more, certainly in the 20th century, and maybe, I don't know, maybe about the 20s or so.
Sure, and especially over the last half decade, there's been a great change in values. In which we're all more concerned about our own personal well-being, a kind of more individualistic focus. It's not just happening in the family. It's happening in how people pick jobs. It's happening in what they do with their lives and their free time. There's much more of a focus on individual satisfaction. And a lot of people say, well, that's terrible, but very few of those people want to give up themselves the option of thinking about their personal happiness. So in a way, I think what's happened is, because we're a more prosperous country than we used to be, although not the past couple of years, we're kind of given, for the first time, given the luxury of thinking about our own emotional satisfaction. You know, in the 20s, when my grandparents were raising 10 children during the Depression, if you had said to them, do you feel personally satisfied about your marriage? Are you getting the personal growth you need out of it? They would have said, what are you talking about? We're raising 10 kids. It's the Depression. Yeah. But now that we're a little more prosperous and don't have to worry about our next meal, most of us at least, we can have the luxury of thinking about our own personal satisfaction, and it's a double-edged sword. It can bring us a lot of happiness, but it can also cause a lot of change and disruption in our lives.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting and what shows you just how pervasive that attitude is that even among people who identify as, conservative religious folks, that just about as much, they may be very conservative on a lot of other social issues, but when it comes to divorce, their attitudes are actually much more like the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think American religion, accepts divorce and also kind of reinforces in a way sometimes this personal message. You know, some people, when they go to church, hear a message that says, here's how you can do better on the job, or here's some lessons that can help you find a good partner. It's about you. It's about your own personal satisfaction. And so even in religion, in religious services these days, we find this message that says your personal growth is important. It's pervasive. It's throughout our society, and it's one of the reasons why it shows up so much in our family lives.
Another caller here, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder how much economic changes have affected prevalence of marriage, particularly for high school or non-high school graduates. The income distribution has shifted greatly over the last 40 years so that they actually are not better off. And the instability of relationships and the tendency not to marry, I suspect, is very much related to the economic instability.
For sure. You know, what's happening is that the college-educated middle class and the high school-educated, I call them the working class, are growing apart in ways that I think are very troubling. You know, in the 1950s, there was a huge Bethlehem Steel plant here in Baltimore, where I'm talking from, that employed 25,000 people, good wages, good benefits. Now they employ only a few thousand people. They make as much steel as they used to because they've automated, but the jobs aren't there. And throughout this country, the kind of blue-collar, as we called it, factory jobs, that was the meat and potatoes of people with a high school degree is not there anymore. And the current recession has made this even worse. What you have then is a generation of high school educated young men and women who maybe are the first generation in history that will do worse than their parents did economically. They'll make less than their parents did. And that economic change, I think, has made people hesitant to marry. They don't feel they have the economic security that would allow them to marry, and so they don't. I think that along with the value change that we've been talking about toward personal growth and individualism, it's been a big change in our economy. It's really hurting people who can't get into the upper reaches of our economy where the only good jobs seem to be.
May I make another comment? Your observation that divorce no longer was an impediment to running for president, I think, is quite accurate. But we still have only one president who was divorced and actually also remarried, Ronald Reagan.
Yes, I was thinking of presidential candidates. We've had a number of people running for president who are divorced, and that doesn't seem to be a problem. But, you know, it's interesting that Ronald Reagan is the one who was divorced and remarried, because here is a conservative American president. Here is the president who is most admired by conservatives, and nobody seems to care that he was divorced and remarried. So, you know, it's not just liberals who are accepting of divorce, it's conservatives too. In fact, the 10 states with the highest divorce rates in this country all voted for George Bush in 2008, and 8 out of 10 voted for John McCain. I'm sorry, all voted for George Bush in 2004, 8 out of 10 voted for John McCain in 2008. So it's pervasive in this country. It's not just liberals, it's everybody who seems to say, divorce isn't a great thing, but, you know, we'll accept it. We'll accept it. It's not a black mark against you as it might have been in the past.
Well, you know John Milton's observation on divorce. It was better than murder.
John Milton was one of the first people to say divorce is not so bad. and under circumstances like you just mentioned, you might want to do it. Through time, there have been some people making this case, but the case has been accepted much more by many more people over the last 50 years, especially in this country.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. And I do, someone here was listening to the conversation and by email sent a little snippet from the libretto to Leonard Bernstein's opera Candide, where there, you know, this is the opera where people are always singing about that it's the best of all possible worlds. And there's a section where there's a dialogue between two characters and they're talking about marriage. And one says, well, I really don't quite understand it. Why is it married people fight? And the response is that the private strife of man and wife is useful to the nation. It's a harmless outlet for emotions that could lead to war or social agitation.
We're allowed to express our opinions and our difficulties in marriage, and it keeps us from doing it outside of the house.
I guess that's right, and it ends up with people with again the character talking about why does it people get married? It's so wonderful that many ask no better than to wed as often as they can in happy repetition. So that's the thing about marriage, is we believe in marriage so much that we do it over and over and over again.
That's right. That's right. It's such a good thing that if first you don't succeed, you try it again.
That's what we do.
You know, it's not just that we have high marriage and divorce rates. Our divorced Americans get remarried faster and more than to people in other countries. You know, we don't stay single as long. We seem to want to partner up again. You know, try it again if it didn't work the first time. And so not only do we end our relationships a lot more quickly than in other places, but we find new ones more quickly. It's as if we're uncomfortable unless we're partnered up. If we're not, we try to find somebody to start a new partnership with. That's a characteristic of the U.S.
Our guest in this hour is Andrew Cherlin. He is professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins University, and he has published books and articles on a number of topics: marriage and divorce, children's well-being, intergenerational relations, family policy, welfare policy. His recent book, which is now out in paper, is The Marriage Go-Round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today. And it is published by Vintage. It's in paper. It's out now if you'd like to look at it. Questions, comments certainly are welcome too. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line, so it would be a long-distance call for you. Use that, and you can also send us email at will-talk@illinois.edu. I expect that you probably have taken a look, as well as looking at attitudes toward marriage in this country, and you've talked a little bit about attitudes in other countries. What do people in Europe, for example, think about Americans and the way that we approach marriage?
They think we're pretty strange. They ask, why is marriage so important? People like the French, for example, most of whom seem to think marriage is a old-fashioned institution, just can't understand why we're so hung up about it from their perspective. And it's because there's been less importance on it than it is here. So they think we're pretty odd because how much we value marriage. On the other hand, when we get to know what they do over there, we think they're a little odd in the way that they think about controlling who has children or not. For instance, couples in France who have a registered civil partnership, like a living-together relationship, aren't allowed to adopt. Here, anybody can adopt. You know, in Europe, marriage is not that important. Who has kids is important. Here, it's always marriage is important. We don't worry about who has kids, how many kids they have, because we've always had enough. But we do really care about marriage. And so there's a disconnect between what we do and the Europeans, who are as puzzled by us as we are about them. Mm.
Well, this attitude, the European attitude toward having children and who have them, does that have something to do with demographics, in the sense that you need to have people having babies to have a country? Or are they concerned about the country's demographic makeup and who, in terms of their socioeconomic or ethnic status, is having children?
Well, as you said, these are small countries that are right next to each other, and the French have been worried for a century or more about having enough French people to field an army to defend themselves against the Germans. Mm. And so this does come from a fear of not having enough population. Today, for the first time, many European countries are trying to come to terms with immigrant populations, and they're a little worried about them. We have a long history here of accepting immigration. Even though we're still debating it, we're much more comfortable with having people from other countries come here and populate our country than are the French or the Germans or other countries that care more about keeping themselves pure, so to speak. So what happens is, because of all those factors, over there in Europe, they're very concerned about having enough children, who has them, whereas here, we are not concerned about having enough children. We can always bring in some immigrants if we don't have enough of them, and we're much more comfortable with it than is the case in Europe.
Well, Dan, maybe this will bring us back for a moment or two to the controversy in this country surrounding same-sex marriage. We talked about that a little bit earlier, and the fact that because we have so much invested in the institution of marriage here in this country, because it is so important, that's why there's such a battle over what marriage is and who may marry.
That's what I think. So a lot of people portray the gay marriage concerns to be about rights, to be about law, and who has the right to make decisions if their partner's in the hospital, who has the right to stay in an apartment, who has the right to file taxes with a partner. And a lot of it is initially voiced in terms of, we need gay marriage because of rights. But I don't think it's all about rights. If it were all about rights, then civil unions would be enough. You know, if all you cared about was having the same rights given to same-sex couples as opposite-sex couples, you wouldn't need marriage. The fact that you do need marriage suggests that it's also a battle about the symbol of marriage. It's also a battle about what marriage says about you in this country. What it says is, you have a first-class personal life. When the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 2004 said there has to be same-sex marriage, we rule in its favor, they said, if you're not married, you're pretty much a second-class citizen, and the Massachusetts Constitution prohibits second-class citizenship. I'm not sure that's the case in Europe, but I do think it's true here that marriage is the first-class way of doing your personal life. And so doesn't it make sense that the same-sex marriage issue here is all about who gets to have that ring, who gets to have that symbol? That's why it's such a difficult issue here. We're not just fighting about rights. We're fighting about who owns the symbols of marriage? Who owns the rights to have this badge of first-class personal life? Mm. It's only here in the U.S. that we've had such a difficult battle. In some of the European countries, like France or England, there's not much activity on the part of activists about marriage. They don't care so much about being married. In other countries, gay marriage has been passed without a lot of concern. Like Canada is an example of a country like that. It's only here that we've had such a battle, because it's not just a battle about rights for us. It's a battle about who gets the privilege of showing themselves to be married. And that's why it's such a difficult issue.
Well, people have thought about how this issue has developed and how in the future it's likely to go. And I think that some people have made the argument that younger people tend to be more relaxed in their attitudes towards homosexuality. So that might suggest that over time, the societal attitude will change. But if also, though, younger people continue to have this idea in their heads about marriage, I mean, maybe they're willing to put it off, but they still, it still seems to be an important kind of indicator of your standing in society. If they continue to carry with them that more traditional sort of view of marriage, then what do you see happening with this issue over time?
What we see even today is a huge difference according to age on whether you favor same-sex marriage. There's almost no social issue that shows such a difference by age than we see in that one. And what we see is that older Americans, by and large, are against same-sex marriage. And the older you are, the more against it you are. Younger Americans are more in favor of it. People in their 20s, a majority of them are in favor of it. So there's a huge gap by age, which suggests that as younger people get older and become the dominant group in our nation, attitudes will change, that there will be more acceptance and support for same-sex marriage. But as you say, maybe what also is going to happen is that everybody will think marriage is less important, so the issue might fade away in the sense that marriage might not be seen as so important for everybody. But I do think the case that over the next 10 and 20 years, we're going to see a change in attitudes. In fact, we've already seen one in the past few years. And I think it's because younger people are more accepting of this. Mm-hmm. You know, for an older American who's been married for 40 or 50 years, it's very hard to think about same-sex marriage. You know, it just wasn't something that was in your mindset when you were thinking about marriage yourself. Today, for a young person who's coming of age at a different time when we're more concerned about our own personal growth and making choices is okay, it seems to be much more okay to think about same-sex marriage. A huge split then, according to age, which I think will mean that attitudes are going to shift. And in 20 years, I'm confident that a majority of people will be in favor of same-sex marriage, even maybe 5 or 10 years from now.
Yeah. I think, some people make this observation that it's curious that, on the one hand, we should have so many people concerned about the future of marriage, wanting to, you know, to the point that they think that the government actually ought to be promoting marriage. So we have that, and then we have this group of people, same-sex couples, who really want to be married, and yet it seems that the first group doesn't want to let the second group be married, and it doesn't seem to make sense that you would, if you have people lining up to marry, and you're concerned about the institution of marriage, you'd say, fine. Good. People want to get married? Great. We'll have more marriages. But no, that doesn't follow.
And there are some American political conservatives who make exactly that argument. The Solicitor General in the Bush administration, Ted Olson, is now joining with a liberal counterpart in a suit urging same-sex marriage. Commentator Andrew Sullivan, a political commentator, has made the same idea, which is, if you think that marriage is the best way for people to live a stable life, and if you think of it as a traditional institution, why wouldn't you let more people in on it? So for sure, that argument is made across the political spectrum, and people on the other side say, well, yes, but it's conceived of as a man and a woman. That's the way it's always been, and we just can't come to the conclusion that it would be good to extend it to people who haven't traditionally been allowed.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Andrew Cherlin. He's a sociologist. He's a professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins University and has written a good deal on marriage and divorce, on children and their well-being, on family policy, on welfare policy. His book is The Marriage Go-Round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today. It's a book that was originally published a couple of years ago in 2009, is now available in a paperback edition. It's published by Vintage. If you'd like to read it, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Going back to the topic about having children and who and attitudes about having children cross-culturally, different attitudes, my understanding is that in many European countries, such as France, when a married couple has a child, they automatically get a pay increase and a stipend because it's expensive to raise children, and the country likes to support that. It's, I think, very different in our country. You have children, that's your problem, and you take care of them. What do you think about that?
I think you're exactly right. And in France, where that comes from is a historical fear of not having enough children. We'll pay you if you have some kids. You know, we'll make your life easier. We'll provide a family allowance for you. Just please have some babies so we can increase the French population. The fact that we here in the U.S. have never been so worried about that, I think part of the reason why we say, if you have kids, it's your problem. It's not just that we feel that the government should stay out of personal life. We think that having children is a private decision. What that means today is that it's increasingly hard for couples to afford to have a lot of kids, even one kid. It's increasingly hard because it costs so much now to have a child and to send that child to college, and yet we don't provide as much support as many other nations, and therefore Americans have a more difficult time. They have fewer kids, and they also have more problems in their marriage as they argue about finances in a way that other countries don't.
And then how does the adoption circumstance equal or figure into that equation of getting support from the government or your country when you adopt children, and why wouldn't maybe that figures into why they don't allow people to adopt as readily in other countries?
I think because of the fear of not having enough babies, European countries are very concerned about who has children, the conditions under which they have them. We're much more live and let live here. For example, we let lesbian partners have access to in vitro fertilization, you know, artificial fertilization techniques in most states whenever they want. But in many European states, they don't. So oddly enough, because they're so concerned about kids, they seem to be very worried about who has them. Here, we're less worried. We're happy for you to have a kid, whoever you are. But by the way, please take care of that kid yourself. You're not going to get a lot of assistance once you do. I think that's the message that we give families here.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Just we're coming down to maybe about 4 or 5 minutes, and I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about this notion that we have had here, at least over the past few years in this country, that government should be promoting marriage. It seems odd, though, that other than waging a kind of public relations campaign that says marriage is great, go out and get married as long as you're a man and a woman, that we haven't really provided much in the way of support, at least not the kind of support. Maybe it's just we're talking about children and family leave and health care and so forth, that we don't seem to provide anything like the kind of supports to married couples that they do in Europe. But at the same time, we're saying, but it's really important to get married, and why don't you go out and do it?
So we'd like you to get married, but we're not going to give you as much help as other countries do once you do it.
Yeah.
I think there's been a fear here that if single parents are also given these subsidies after they have kids, will undermine marriage. I don't think that's the case. It seems to me that if we're concerned about stable relationships for kids, all parents ought to be able to get some help. Help, for example, giving them some assistance if they have a job, maybe some wage support if they have a job, some child care support if they have a job. That what we need to do to really back up the idea of more stable care for kids is to provide more assistance to parents, all kinds of parents, so that they will be able to make the kids' lives stable, steady, and good. And that's kind of what we'd like to do. I think that promoting marriage is not a bad idea if it is done at the same time as we promote other kinds of families having stable lives. Let's help single parents have a stable life, too. So I have a problem just promoting marriage, but I don't have a problem saying marriage is, in fact, a good way to have kids, and we think people ought to have stable relationships, and marriage is often the way to do it. There are billboards in Baltimore that say, marriage works, have marriage, with smiling young couples. It seems to me that's not the most productive way to encourage marriage. Let's give people some assistance. Let's allow these young adults who would love to marry if they could find a partner with a steady job. Let's make it easier for them to do that.
And that's what I think one of those things that you point to that maybe even one of the things that kind of got you interested in doing more work in this area, that is, you see a billboard like that in the United States. You go to France, to England, to Germany, to Sweden. You're not going to see something like that.
I actually have seen ads on the side of buses in Baltimore saying marriage works. You don't find that in any other country. It's the odd way in which we seem to promote marriage at the expense of other kinds of relationships that seems to be defining us as different. It's always all about marriage here, and in Europe it's all about having kids. I'm saying it should be all about stable environments for kids. Mm. Marriage is a very good environment. We ought to encourage it. But let's allow other parents, like single parents, to also be able to have a stable environment. And if we want to encourage marriage, let's note that the young adults who are not doing it are the ones who are saying, I can't find a decent job in my town. That's a problem made worse by the current recession that's, I think, hindering marriage.
Is there any reason to believe that the kinds of pro-marriage campaigns that have been launched here in the United States have actually led to more people thinking about getting married or getting married?
I don't think so. You know, I think most young adults want to get married, but they see it as something you only do when you have the rest of your life set, and they can't get the rest of their life set. And it's that problem, not wanting to get married, which is the issue. And that's why I think the campaigns, the kind of public relations campaigns, don't really do much to help things, because most people will agree that marriage is good. That's not the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is, how can I do it successfully? Help me do it successfully is what I would like you to help me do.
Our guest is Andrew Cherlin. He is professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He is the author of a number of articles and books having to do with things like marriage and divorce and children and family policy. His book, if you'd like to read it, is The Marriage Go-Round, The State of Marriage and the Family in America Today, published now in paper by Vintage. And Professor Cherlin, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. It was first broadcast in January of this year. Many shows from Focus and our news production, a lot of other things, are available for you to listen to anytime that you like. It's on our website. Just go to willill.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. WILL programming is made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn works with family and friends to create a plan to support residents' health and independence and provide them with a sense of belonging. More information is available at 384-0100.
And that's it for Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, May wheat trading at 848 and a quarter, up 3 and a quarter. July, 859 and a quarter, up 3 and a half. May wheat in Chicago, 728 and a quarter, up 5 1/4. July, 764 and a quarter, up 5 3/4. May corn, 686 and a quarter, up 2 3/4. July, 692 and 3/4, up 2 3/4. September, 643, up 6. December, 604 and a half, up 6. May soybeans, 1360 and a half, down 2. July, 1370 and a quarter, down 1 1/4. August, 1366 and a half, down 3/4. September, 1353, up 2 1/4. May meal, 364.60, down 330. May oil, 55.89, up 12. April live cattle, 113 even, up 135.